Welcome to the HC Insider Podcast, a podcast dedicated to the commodities sector and the people within it. I'm your host, Paul Chapman.
Today we return to the carbon markets with Ariel Perez, Head of Environmental Products at Hartree Partners. Ariel last joined us in the summer of 2021, so we pick up the story there. How did the carbon markets fare through the energy crisis triggered by Russia's invasion of Ukraine? What have been the market developments? And what are the policy developments in both compliance and voluntary markets? How is the European Carbon Border Adjustment Mechanism changing the landscape for carbon markets? And what can we expect over the coming year? As always, you can really support the show by leaving us a positive review on the platform you're listening on. And as always, I hope you enjoyed the episode. Ariel, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me. It's nice to be back.
So we last spoke, had you on the show, summer of 2021. So in part, this episode is kind of picking up where we left off and what's happened to the carbon markets, both compliance and voluntary since then, how that's impacted participants and how policies have evolved globally as well since that date. The next significant event after we spoke was obviously Russia's invasion of Ukraine. Can you sort of pick that story up there? Because that did have a profound impact on the carbon markets.
Sure. I would say just preceding that, actually, you know, the COP in Glasgow in the end of 2020-21 was a pretty big moment as well, because we finally saw countries kind of come to a, let's call it a preliminary agreement on Article 6 of the Paris Agreement, which really is what would operationalize and allow for countries to cooperate and trade, you know, emission reductions and essentially part of the emissions cap under the Paris Agreement. And that brought a lot of momentum and investment into physical and voluntary carbon markets. And then, as you rightly point out, a couple months later, we had the invasion of Ukraine. It's hard to overestimate how significant an event that was, not just for carbon markets, but for European energy markets. If you look back now, I mean, we have essentially gone through a period, a very unprecedented period, where the majority of pipeline gas going into Eastern Europe, you know, has effectively been shut. And I think now it's safe to say, you know, probably will remain shut for the foreseeable future. The impact that that had on carbon markets was in the short term relatively muted in comparison to what happened in power and gas markets, which clearly had to trade at levels which would kill demand and would force switching, because there was a literal scarcity of power and gas 2021, 2022. And as a side effect of that, we have afterwards seen a pretty dramatic drop in demand now for carbon, because when you shut an energy-intensive installation, while you save gas or you save power or you save coal, you also don't need the carbon, obviously. So I think a couple of things happened kind of big picture macro-wise. I think it's safe to say that that really accelerated the inflationary pressures that we saw in Europe and, you know, in much of the developing world. That made energy as a percentage of what people spend in terms of the, you know, the CPI basket go towards levels that we really haven't seen since the 70s. And when that happens as a result of, you know, natural gas prices in particular going up, is that it kind of leaves very little room for other feedstocks, if you will, to price higher, because you're pushing up really against very legitimate affordability concerns. So we saw commensurate increase in interest rates across the developed world. We saw a slowdown in industrial production, particularly in Europe. And I think politically, we saw a very pronounced slowdown in terms of investment and money going into projects and going into, you know, traditional kinds of companies and activities that reduce and remove carbon, because of the pressure that we were getting on margins, because the decrease in demand that we saw from the deindustrialization in Europe. And frankly, politically, it was very clearly going down on the list of, let's call it, priorities for, you know, for the head of state and for governing bodies in Europe and in North America, you know, as geopolitics basically moved up the chain.
Yeah, there's a lot to unpack there, and we've closely covered that interest rate narrative and how that has essentially forced a contraction of expected cash flows on these projects that has had an impact on all manner of energy transition projects, especially those with unproven technology and so forth. Just staying on the carbon market, can you firstly give us some orientation to the price in 2021 with all that excitement, as you highlighted, coming off of Glasgow, and then what it immediately did upon invasion? Because there was this kind of this argument that you're turning off natural gas, that will force in the short term coal-fired power stations in Germany, which they did, to fire back up, and you kind of, there was this expectation that there was an invasion, that the carbon market, the compliance market, the ETS, would go up. But in fact, it did the opposite. And what did that tell us about the nature of participants? Or was that actually the real story, as you highlighted, was an expectation of demand destruction overall?
Yeah, I mean, I think that from when we spoke last, I mean, we did, you know, the carbon, the EUA market, particularly in Europe, you know, we traded up to 100 euros summer of 2021. We were trading, oddly enough, just around where we are right now, just under 60 euros a ton. But I just want to put it in perspective. I mean, the implied carbon price as derived from like the difference between natural gas and coal marginal costs, you know, hit 1,000 euros a ton. So the European consumer and companies experienced a 1,000 euro carbon price in effect, even though the price only ever traded up to 100 euros. The way that carbon markets trade and the way that participants manage risk, it has very little to do with what's happening in the immediate future and has very much to do with what's happening kind of in the, let's call it the medium-term forecast, 1 to 3 years out. So even though the lights didn't go off, and even though, you know, we've now obviously seen a dramatic reversion back to long-term, kind of close to long-term levels on European energy prices, we haven't seen a return of demand, and utilities have really reacted accordingly. So unwinding hedges in the back end, essentially releasing supply that's been locked up as part of long-term hedging programs, both on exchanges as well as with, you know, directly against industrial counterparties. And that increase in supply, as well as the decrease in demand that we've seen as a result of high energy prices, as a result of interest rates, you know, has really put a tremendous amount of pressure on the market. Over the last year or so, we've seen the EUA market drop about 40%. What happened in the voluntary market was slightly different. I mean, the voluntary market, it's voluntary, of course. So the amount of real end user demand that market has, you know, that market has is, you know, it's down to individual preferences and behavior of companies that choose to participate in that market, presumably because they're not under any kind of regulatory compliance obligation to reduce carbon, and obviously to surrender any kind of carbon permits. And throughout 2021, leading up to the invasion in Ukraine, you know, that market increased 300 to 400%, and pretty much from right after the invasion in Ukraine happened, the market dropped almost as quickly as it went up, ultimately settling at around a dollar towards the end of last year. And if you look at the fundamentals in that market, we've always had inventory builds, meaning that more tons are being issued from these projects than are ultimately being retired. That was a hallmark of the EU ETS in the first and the second phase. And then, of course, when they reformed the market with the backloading and the MSR, the inventory started to drop very dramatically. And as a result, the price, at the end of the day, went from 4 to 100. The voluntary market has never really seen any material destruction of inventory. Inventory kind of continues to build. There's certain products and certain types of projects today where the inventory is flatlining. It's fair to say that many of these project types are going to be pretty dramatically undersupplied on a forward basis. But we have some really important and difficult questions that need answering around willingness to pay, affordability, sources of capital, distribution and management of risk. And we can go into what I mean by that later. But fair to say, war in Ukraine was an absolute turning point, certainly for the voluntary market, and I think also for the EU market and other compliance carbon markets that are now at various stages of development around the world.
Yeah. Was there any moment when as we the world saw, you know, suddenly energy security was the priority, absolutely, and obviously inflation globally was a serious problem. Was there any moment when there was concern whether the European compliance scheme or other global compliance schemes would be under sort of political threat as a result of the additional costs that they caused?
No. I mean, I don't think that there was ever a risk of them abandoning the scheme. Now, what I would say is that the flexibility that regulators have in these markets and the optionality that they have to move supply kind of temporally, so long as the cap is intact, was exercised. So the European Union brought forward a lot of supply. They want to raise 20 billion euros from selling excess EUA permits. And they basically had the option of how they would spread that out throughout the phase. They decided to front load it for the dual purpose of keeping energy costs low, as well as raising revenue, which they needed to incentivize, to repower EU as a result of obviously losing all of that, that Russian gas and frankly, much wider dislocations in global energy markets. We saw similar things happening in the UK. So the UK program was in its infancy around this time, but the regulator there decided to really front load permits to make sure there was enough liquidity and inventory going into the market. And what you ended up with is a pretty dramatic drop in price. I mean, that those permits are probably trading 60 or 70% below the peak. The interesting thing from my perspective is I think that actually suits policymakers and regulators kind of longer term objectives and agendas right now, because we have seen a pretty fast rebalancing of those markets, as I said, from 4 to 100. And frankly, we're getting a lot of decarbonization, I would argue, involuntarily through the high energy prices that we saw, and now potentially a bit of, you know, shedding of excess capacity and potentially cross-border, you know, imbalances in terms of incentives and, tax breaks and things like that. I'm, of course, referring to the IRA. So this is very much, I think, the intention of policymakers is to have these markets less volatile and pricing relatively lower in the short term. But it's important to add that they don't have infinite flexibility. So the flexibility that they use now, unless they change the rules, will leave them with relatively less tools in the toolkit going forward. It's like when you go to a 0% interest rate world. I mean, of course, you can go negative, but you can no longer cut towards zero. So that's the analogy.
Yeah. So essentially, they've released all that supply early. So if we were to see a similar, you know, challenging event, that flexibility is gone, and you could see a real price spike, I guess. So staying on the compliance markets, before we talk about sort of the policy direction globally and where they're going, just from a trading perspective, and this might be sort of anecdotal in my role as a search firm, there were lots of teams and traders entering the market, lots of organizations wanting to add carbon desks in the wake of COVID and in that sort of global mm-hmm. ESG movement and the interest there, both on the compliance side and on the voluntary side, but staying on compliance, how did the volatility there impact that trend? And indeed, I would imagine that, you know, there's a certain level of sophistication and understanding of the entire sort of carbon ecosystem and policy to be able to kind of predict what would happen. Because again, you know, I guess at a very sort of superficial level, like I said earlier, you know, lots of people were thinking that it would raise the carbon prices, but in fact the opposite happened. I mean, how has that trend of new entrants fared over the last couple of years? And indeed, kind of what learnings were made about how difficult it is to understand the entire carbon, ecosystem to be able to trade it?
The thing, I mean, a lot of the new entrants in this market, I don't think were primarily kind of long-only buy and hold. So a lot of new entrants from the hedge fund community, trading houses, you know, corporates that have some kind of trading presence in the market. So, you know, what I would say is, you know, when you have big moves and there's a lot of volatility, it provides opportunities for traders to benefit from that. So I think it's safe to say that even though the bias was definitely probably on the long side when all of those desks were being built, as evidenced by the positioning reports, you know, the speculative community is short, you know, outright, particularly in Europe. So I would say clearly they managed to position themselves properly. You know, we're not aware of any major new entrants in the market that have just kind of thrown in the towel and said this is not for them because the market has retraced a bit. If anything, you know, I think that carbon is going to be an increasing driver for switching of fuels, incentivizing, and, you know, frankly, prioritizing different technologies to be built, which are going to be critical for the energy transition. And this is really the backdrop that we see now in 2024. So the IRA is operational. It's a unique way to try to reduce emissions. My view, of course, is that you have no idea what the impact of that is going to be until after the fact. So you don't really know what your effective cost of abatement or removal, frankly, is at a jurisdictional level. And with the rise of new compliance markets that are all kind of gravitating towards Europe because of the CBAM, it's going to become even more important to have a presence and to really have a good fundamental view of how these different markets are likely to develop, where they're going to price, what sorts of activities and, you know, products and services will be displaced across borders and within a certain country. So it's, you know, it's absolutely critical for trading companies, industrials, funds, institutional investors, you know, to have an understanding and really a presence in these markets if they are to navigate the next kind of 15 to 25 years effectively, in our view.
Yeah, interesting. And even as you say, without that lens today, it makes it much harder to predict how those energy mixes are impacted, even in the short term, right? So, you know, it does give you that crucial lens. Where are compliance markets going globally? Are we seeing, you know, where legislatively are we seeing more and more on the horizon? And, you know, can you give us some sense of where they're going?
If you think about, you know, really the last 15 to 20 years, the West has very clearly essentially outsourced and exported a huge amount of emissions, you know, via globalization, right? And part of also, I think, what happened in 2022, you know, in the invasion of Ukraine, is it kind of put a stop to that to an extent. So if you look at the EU, you know, the EU emits something like 8% of global emissions, but it's just under 20% of GDP, and it's the biggest importing region in the world. So it's the biggest single market. Now, what the Europeans have for a very long time, and they're starting to implement now, what they intend to do is to really address that carbon leakage, which is really what that is. When you import goods and services from abroad into a region that has carbon pricing, you know, obviously from a region that doesn't have carbon pricing, you know, it's an environmental arbitrage. And, you know, that's another way to think about carbon leakage. So what the EU has decided to do and what they've started the process of is kind of rectifying that via the carbon border adjustment mechanism. And what that border adjustment mechanism is going to do is it's going to equalize every import, starting with a list of, I think, 5 or 6 different commodities and products that get imported into Europe. And it's going to charge them the EUA at the border. There's a provision within the CBAM that allows for the importer of that good to get a rebate for the carbon price that is paid abroad. So the Europeans are pretty clever about this, obviously, and they're totally aware that they can't, with only 8% of the carbon footprint of the world, they can't solve the climate crisis all on their own, and they can't regulate the EU ETS to ultimately provide a global, you know, framework. But what they can do is they can obviously create what is in essence, you know, a tariff at the border that would disincentivize countries abroad from continuing to export goods and services into Europe without themselves putting in place commensurate and I would argue, you know, equally as ambitious climate policies at home. Now, this is just really such a profound change, right? And it's a big question mark, you know, whether it's going to work. And the question, of course, and the other question is, what does success look like? You know, my pretty strong view is that this CBAM is already working. We've seen Turkey, Brazil, India, The Chinese, of course, already have a carbon market. Basically, you know, started that up about 10 years ago when there were first rumblings of this already kind of in Brussels. But it's now going to be, I think, common practice for, in particular, advanced economies to have to, at a very minimum, track, report, and ultimately price carbon domestically if they don't want to then ultimately just give money to the Europeans. Because if you do nothing, we think about this kind of four quadrants. You could either do nothing in terms of carbon pricing, or you can price carbon. And then if you do nothing, you can really do nothing, so have low ambition, or you can have high ambition. And I think really the only two quadrants that kind of make sense, if you think about this geopolitically, is you do nothing, right? Which is what most of the world has done, because essentially they get a bit of a free ride. And, you know, as long as you have critical mass of people doing nothing, then you never get any momentum, you know, around carbon pricing and cap and trade systems, et cetera. Once the Chinese decided that they are on a path where they are going to price carbon and have the world's biggest carbon market, now you have Korea pricing CO2, you have, you know, all those other countries that I mentioned, and you add them all together, you're well over a third, potentially even more, of global carbon priced, and you're significantly more than a third in terms of GDP. So if the majority of dollars that get transacted in the world are subject to either a direct or an indirect carbon price, then the only strategy that makes sense is that you participate and you increase ambition. Because if you participate and you have a low price, then the Europeans will take the difference. And it makes almost no sense to go through all of the political pain of setting up a carbon trading system, as has, for example, been done already in China today, or Indonesia has a regime. But the pricing is so low that if they export, you know, these goods into Europe, the Europeans are going to charge them the EUA and only give them something like a 10% rebate. Politically, that makes no sense from my view. And I think the Europeans, you know, really, and it relates to everything that's happened in the voluntary market. It relates to Article 6 under the Paris Agreement. I think that the European main objective from a climate perspective, you know, over the next couple of years is to make sure that that CBAM becomes operational. But more importantly, it's that other countries see what's happening on the horizon, put in place carbon trading systems, and then increase ambition, which would ultimately result in, you know, let's use the official UN numbers, $50 to $100 carbon price by 2030. And if those things don't happen, then the Europeans are going to tax it for them, which I think is really untenable over the long run.
Yeah, fascinating. The Carbon Border Adjustment Mechanism, to unpack the acronym. So I guess on that quadrant, where does the US sit as the other major, you know, emitter and participant, you know, GDP contributor?
US they're in the top left. They do nothing, and they are not actively leading the charge against it. But I think that politically, it's very difficult to get federal carbon pricing, you know, through in the US. But the U.S. is obviously the elephant in the room. Look, I would argue that getting China on board is arguably more important for the world, because obviously Chinese emissions haven't peaked. You know, there's a tremendous amount of potential growth there in terms of the CO2 base, whereas in the U.S., you know, global, you know, U.S. emissions have peaked. Obviously, it's at the other end of the development kind of spectrum. But the Americans, you know, this is going to impact the Americans indirectly, because they're now obviously a massive exporter of hydrocarbons. So over time, if the rest of the world is under a de facto carbon price, it impacts the U.S. just as a, you know, the world's biggest economy and, you know, a major trading partner to most countries. Funnily enough, the U.S., you know, the U.S. has talked about putting in place a CBAM itself. I don't really understand on what basis if there's no carbon price. For example, the Indians have said that they're going to put a carbon tax on exports. The UK is now considering putting in place a carbon border adjustment mechanism. And it makes sense. From my view, the end state here is the majority of carbon, particularly in the developed world, is under some kind of carbon trading regime. We think that the EUA is essentially going to be, let's call it, the reserve currency, or the kind of the benchmark for global carbon. And I think this is really kind of pretty transformative also for the developing world and middle income countries, because part of, I think, what has really slowed progress on the voluntary market and on, let's call it the Paris Agreement in Article 6, is the lack of benchmarks. You know, you have no pricing benchmarks in a lot of countries, right? And if you don't have a pricing benchmark for carbon, which is not compulsory, how can anybody ever make a decision on what the right price is to pay or what sorts of projects should be prioritized and, you know, and whether we should do DAC as opposed to avoiding deforestation? And, you know, you can't really have a meaningful, fundamentally sound conversation, and certainly not, you know, certainly you can't make a set of decisions unless you have benchmarks, you know, pricing benchmarks to evaluate a series of options and different projects against each other. So I think that's what the CBAM is ultimately going to achieve. It's going to make countries put in place systems, increase ambition, cooperate in terms of sharing information. And even if you end up with a scenario where the European price is 100 and the rest of the world is 50, that's then basis for a negotiation, right? And I think the reality is, I don't think the Europeans are doing this to collect a bunch of money. They really are doing it to make sure that they're not the odd ones out, and that it makes Europe structurally uncompetitive while allowing the world to lag in terms of climate ambition. So I think that's the end game for that policy.
The HC Insider podcast is brought to you by HC Group, a retained search, intelligence and advisory firm focused solely on the global energy and commodity sector. With 6 locations across Asia, Europe and the Americas, and over 50 consultants. To find out more, go to our website, hcgroup.global. There, you can also sign up for our HC Insider content for more interviews and white papers on relevant trends and talent impacts in the commodities world.
Let's move on to voluntary markets. Can you give us a bit of a narrative of the last year there? You've already highlighted, obviously, the impact of interest rates, and when money gets tighter, so do decisions and largesse and so forth. But yeah, what's the story on the voluntary markets? And then, I guess, weaving it, how those could, you know, what their narrative would be in that more global compliance regime that the CBAM might create?
Yeah, look, I think for a lot of observers and participants in the market, the voluntary market was always meant to be a stopgap. So absent global cooperation and absent some sort of kind of global compliance regime, the voluntary markets would be there to sort of mop up residual emissions, you know, particularly, you know, within companies and with countries that have higher ambition than they're legally required to have. You know, we now have a framework which is demonstrably increasing ambition in compliance markets around the world. I think that's really being spearheaded by the Europeans. We had very legitimate concerns around profitability and affordability, you know, in corporates who at $2 or $3 a ton kind of make sense. But once the price got to $10, $15, $20 and significantly higher today, if you're talking about carbon removals, I think companies just kind of instinctively ask the question, you know, why are we taxing ourselves to this amount? You know, and I think the reality is you need regulatory frameworks and you need pricing benchmarks in order to make any market succeed. It's not just the voluntary market, it's any market. So I think the voluntary market came under a lot of pressure and scrutiny, and some of that scrutiny was absolutely warranted. And I think the market is undergoing a series of reforms right now, which I think is going to bring a lot of confidence back. Our view is higher interest rates, heightened geopolitical risk, because that was another hallmark of the market over the last kind of 24 months. It's by definition, you know, the voluntary market is global. But obviously, if you have a portfolio across 20 countries, you have 20 very different geopolitical, you know, situations, election cycles, you know, land property rights, royalty negotiations, currency, risk of default. I mean, it's pretty complex if you think about an investor or a company managing that large amount of risk, which is what you'd want to have in a portfolio, so you have a bit of diversification. And really what transpired over the last couple of years was, you know, countries, particularly in the global south, waking up to the implicit value that they had in, you know, natural assets, the ability to reduce and remove carbon at pricing levels that were significantly below the opportunities in the West. That's obviously the basis of the Paris Agreement, Article 6, for countries to cooperate and be able to achieve the goals of the Paris Agreement at a lower price. But what, you know, what actually manifested for the market is you saw markets getting nationalized. You saw governments passing regulation where they would take, where they would want to take, 30, 40, 50% of all of the carbon as a royalty or as a stream. And what that did is, you know, it massively increased the risk of investing in projects and developing projects. And at the end of the day, pricing can solve all of that. But what the market is grappling with today is, you know, what is the willingness to pay for a voluntary credit? What type of credit is going to be acceptable, you know, to make a corporate claim? What kind of credit is going to be acceptable for me to use against a voluntary target as set forth, for example, in SBTI? Those questions have not yet been answered. But our pretty strong view is that a combination of broader, better coordinated compliance markets and the resulting benchmarks, we will get a breakthrough on the Paris Agreement in Article 6. And then from that, I think you have a pretty strong foundation for the voluntary market to basically fill in the gaps of whatever is left. And we really hope that those gaps are, you know, are getting smaller and smaller, you know, as more and more countries decide to regulate and put in place top-down mechanisms and markets to price and to reduce carbon.
Yeah. And sorry, this might sound a bit simplistic, but essentially the concept as well is that your country-specific voluntary credits would flip into whatever future compliance market might come around in that country.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think that and the other one is, you know, that they could ultimately become what are called ITMOs, which is basically the currency of the Paris Agreement. It's an internationally transferred mitigation outcome. So now the market is rightfully very, very focused on which projects today can be registered on a voluntary basis, but in the future could be grandfathered into the Paris Agreement as an ITMO, or would be fungible against a compliance market obligation in a domestic or regional carbon market.
Yeah, fascinating. Okay, so looking forward, I really appreciate the overview of the last couple of years and the intricacies there. You know, what came out of COP28? What does 29 look like? What's the sort of the outlook right now? You've obviously highlighted some of that with the CBAM, but more broadly, what do you think 24 holds and beyond?
Yeah, I mean, I think the big surprise in the last COP, at least from the market's perspective, is really how wide apart different countries are on Article 6. So there's two parts of Article 6 that kind of that really matter. You have Article 6.2, which really governs government-to-government bilateral transactions, very little room for the private sector. And then 6.4, which is really the successor of the Clean Development Mechanism. And that is when most people think about, quote, the global carbon market, they're referring to Article 6.4. Now, it's important to go back a little bit in history, right? The concept of a corresponding adjustment, which is what allows a credit to actually be an ITMO, right? And what that means is that for every credit that is exported from what's called a host country where the project sits, a corresponding adjustment on the accounting ledger, on the carbon accounting ledger, has to be made so that there's no double counting. Now, that's a pretty big deal, right? It's a big deal because what it means is that the country that exports that credit has to think really hard about the price that it's receiving, right? And how it's going to reinvest that money to reduce an additional ton of carbon. Because for every ton that you reduce and then export as an ITMO, you need to reduce another ton in order to get back to zero. So every ton that is an ITMO theoretically should represent 2 tons of carbon abatement or removal in the medium term. Now, this concept was first introduced into the Kyoto Protocol in 1997. So the Europeans have been arguing for this and trying to get this in the text for a very long time. And it made it into Kyoto, but it didn't actually ultimately get grandfathered into the Clean Development Mechanism, which meant that all of the CERs and all of the ERUs that traded in the market, you know, Europe in the end imported over 1.5 billion tons of them, didn't require corresponding adjustments. So the cost of exporting a credit right? For a host country was zero from an accounting perspective and from a fundamental perspective. So this obviously was, from the European perspective, a massive mistake. We think today there would be zero oversupply in the EU ETS market if it wasn't for the importation of all of those CERs. I think that's a fact. So the Europeans are quite adamant about not reliving that and making that same mistake under the Paris Agreement, which, you know, really is the last chance that we have, aside from some technological breakthrough, to kind of cooperate and try to keep warming, you know, well below 2 degrees. So now the Europeans, in my view, are flexing their muscles and are using the leverage that they have, you know, within the COP. They have, you need unanimity, and they have probably the majority of the votes and certainly the majority of the resources, you know, involved in, you know, let's call it global climate policymaking and R&D and research, et cetera. So what the Europeans really, I think, are starting to do is to really turn up the pressure on other countries to increase their ambition, not just in terms of how they price carbon, but also how they view quality, how they manage and how they, you know, communicate risk. Concepts like, you know, integrity, which I think is relatively subjective. But all of these movements that you're seeing, I think, are part of a, you know, of a pretty well choreographed strategy on behalf of the European Union. They want to make sure that the voluntary market or the Paris Agreement is not a substitute for government-led ambition and regulation on scope 1 and scope 2 emissions domestically. That ultimately was a bit of a shock, I think, in the last COP, because people were really hoping for a breakthrough on Article 6.4, and the Europeans were quite reluctant to negotiate in terms of being flexible on quality, being flexible on accounting rules. They really are driving a hard bargain in terms of, you know, requiring corresponding adjustments. They have allowed, for example, the international aviation sector to set up its own trading system, which is called CORSIA. But of course, in order for you to use a credit within CORSIA, you need a corresponding adjustment. And I think the market didn't really appreciate, you know, really the profoundness of that, because in order for you to get a corresponding adjustment, you need to have a good faith agreement with the government. And for a government to give you a good faith agreement, it needs to understand its own kind of marginal abatement cost curve, the ability to actually go and stand up projects and register them and have them monitored internationally. It needs to have a framework to reinvest money so that it's not running into a deficit from a carbon, you know, from like a NDC perspective. And many of the countries that have voluntary projects don't have that capability. They don't have that capacity. It's getting built, but really it's getting built relatively slowly because it's all happening through philanthropy or overseas development aid, you know, frankly, or charitable, you know, foundational kind of, you know, foundation type resources, which is all good, but it's just not happening at the pace. And I think it's not happening in many instances at the right level of government in order to really, you know, start having an honest negotiation and debate around Article 6 and cooperation. And certainly the Europeans are are not even really opening the door for international offsets to ever come into the EU ETS, partly because of the bad experience they had with the Clean Development Mechanism and the lack of corresponding adjustments, really allowing the market to be flooded. So that's, you know, that's the European stance. And I think that became pretty evident at the end of COP.
Yeah, yeah. And your sense is probably unlikely to change given those bad experiences. Or is there hope in COP29?
Well, you see, I think that there is hope. I mean, there is hope because there's progress on the primary objective, which is expanding compliance, carbon markets and carbon pricing. So provided that the world moves in that direction, then there's obviously going to be progress on Article 6. I mean, it really is. I mean, remember, this is politics. So there's a degree of horse trading. There's a degree of negotiation here. But, you know, we pretty strongly believe that you need to have benchmark compliance carbon pricing regionally in place across the majority of the country in order for any kind of economy or portfolio of projects to be built. Because otherwise, how do you know what it's worth? How do you know, and how can you hedge it? How does a buyer make a decision as to whether they should pay the compliance price at home, whether they should take a bit more risk, but probably get a cheaper credit abroad? You know, it's impossible. And so long as companies and as institutions can't properly evaluate and manage risk the way they do across their core businesses, then this is going to remain a relatively undeveloped, you know, and relatively small market, which we hope doesn't happen.
Yeah. Is the argument, therefore, at least from the European perspective, that the CBAM is going to drive that march towards compliance markets and 6.4 is essentially becomes less relevant?
I don't know if it's less relevant, because even if every country in the world had its own, let's just make this argument, if every country in the world had a carbon market and the price was the same in every single country, the relevance of 6.4 is that different countries can reduce and remove carbon at different levels, at different pricing levels. So it still would encourage efficiency gains if the whole world was under one carbon price, but certain countries would be able to trade with other countries and exchange money for environmental services. There would be an efficiency gain globally from that. And globally, yeah, that would lower the cost of compliance. Let's say you have to think about this is like, if the Paris Agreement was a global compliance market, right? The first step is you need to get it in place and it needs to be legislated and it needs to exist. The second thing is you need to make sure that it's affordable, right? That it's as efficient as possible. And it gives all of the participants flexibility for them to be able to compete and manage risks and make real decisions and really have this managed by decision makers within that organization or that institution, as opposed to a sustainability team or a marketing team, you know, which is really not making, you know, large CapEx decisions. They're not deciding in terms of what sorts of technologies they're going to invest into. It's really it's a budget, you know, and a procurement question rather than a strategic capital allocation and risk management question.
Yeah, and you need efficient markets, you know, Adam Smith, to solve for that, right? Not, as you say, PR teams or sustainability teams, and you need that ability for countries to optimize based on their geographies and situation and so on. Fascinating. Is there, you know, I guess wrapping things up, you know, as you look over the next year or so, is there anything that's giving real pause that could have an outsized impact on the market? I mean, it's hard to ask you to stare into a crystal ball, but are there any other things that we should all be looking out for that could have a critical impact?
It depends on which market you're referring to. But I think, you know, look, I think to put in perspective, the CBAM reporting phase started in the fourth quarter of last year, and the first compliance phase is 2026. That's kind of right around the corner. So we'll see within 2 years whether companies and countries comply, whether any of their complaints, you know, and kind of, let's call it the complaints of WTO will be successful or not. Obviously, we have a presidential election in the U.S. in a few months. I'm not sure that really matters that much, because the U.S. already, you know, is not really participating in these markets. Obviously, if the IRA gets rolled back in any meaningful way, that should put the U.S. kind of further behind as far as the, you know, as far as their Paris targets are concerned. But I mean, probably the single biggest change to look out for over the next 12 months is how the Chinese market develops. Are they going to expand that to different sectors? I would argue that they would be doing so, at least in part, as a reaction to the European CBAM. And if that happens, you know, if you get a European Chinese overt, you know, cooperation statement on climate, I mean, that would be really material, right? That's like almost 40% of global GDP. That's over 40% of emissions. I mean, that's that's a really big deal. And obviously, it would isolate the U.S. to an extent. Hmm. So I think that
and
could
catalyze
be,
those other, you know, other countries.
Sure. And I think you have regional markets. You have, you know, Korea has a carbon market. I mean, they're kind of in that bottom left quadrant where they have a market, but it's not very ambitious. It's kind of, you know, sub $10 a ton. That doesn't really make any sense from my view. You know, the Japanese have pretty firm long-term decarbonization targets. They have, you know, objectives to meet in terms of procuring carbon from abroad, you know, as part of Article 6, but they don't have a national carbon trading system. You know, their power market is being reformed and is obviously being liberalized to an extent and opening up. So between Korea, Japan, and China, you know, if those countries get their act together and start really pricing carbon and talking and cooperating with Europe, you know, that would have a profound impact on global gas markets, aluminium, steel markets. Obviously, what do you do with potentially, you know, hundreds of millions or billions of tons that might be displaced in China? I mean, it's going to be fascinating.
Yeah, it sounds like
time will tell.
Trading floors across the world need to have that quadrant on the whiteboard and start mapping what countries do, right? So, yeah, fascinating. Well, it's been a really enjoyable conversation, I hope, and a really excellent update on our last one, which I'll refer people back to in the show notes. And hopefully we can have you back on again in not such a long period of time in between, but, you know, next year or so, and see where the markets stand. As you say, it's a pivotal time and there's some key things to look out for.
Totally agree. Well said. Thanks again for having me on.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this episode and want to support the show, please give us a positive review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify.
To find out more about HC Insider and HC Group, a search and advisory firm dedicated to the commodity markets, visit our website at www.hcgroup.global. There you can find out more about our services and our offices around the world. There you can also find more content, from interviews to insight pieces to more podcasts focused on the commodity value chains. Thanks again for listening.